does everybody like sitting in the back? Is that what it is? A bimodal distribution here. Seats are not reserved. You can sit anywhere you want. But if you want to come and move up front, that would you can do that. You don't have to, but okay. So. So first comment is courtesy of Bill Schumann. There are persimmons and guavas, right?
Yeah.
For your taking.
Organic.
Thanks, sir. Second thing is, I kind of requested, prayed as much as I could, but it just isn't steaming hot in here, and I'm totally dejected by
it. We can warm it up.
Better snow soon, I'll tell you. Because we have a lot to do today, I think let's be prompt about doing it. Okay, so I'm going to talk to you a little bit about mindfulness, not much, and then I'm going to take the training wheels off. And you're going to practice for 10 minutes on your own. So you won't have my voice guiding you. So let me set it up just to kind of review for you what is happening. Now, you can do anything you want in these 10 minutes. You can take a snooze, or you can do your, a usual practice that you do. But if you're doing mindfulness, you're doing two seemingly opposite things. In that, while I remember, if you haven't been signing in, please go back to that list and check off all the weeks that you were here, because I just read. I don't go checking off, although I can see most of who's here. I do read those to see who's here. So I know that you're here, even if I don't say hello to you each week. But try to keep that accurate if you can. So go back and make check marks where you have been here. If you're getting CEUs, make sure you sign that each time. All right, so mindfulness seems to be two, at first blush, two sort of opposite things. Kamiko.
Can I interrupt you for maybe a minute or two to tell you about this? This, if you need it now, it is very sour and
beautiful. Oh, wait, I'm going to give you a microphone, if I can find one.
Oh, you got the persimmons?
Yeah.
That's how it needs to be soft, completely soft.
Okay, so what Kamiko and Bill are telling you is the persimmons, you don't eat them when they're hard. They don't taste good. You have to wait until they're soft. And I have a tip for you about that, which is wait until they're pretty soft. Then put them in the freezer, and then slice them, and they taste really good. Yes, they taste fantastic. Though.
They're also a good filling.
Yes. Okay. Take the center off.
And then you put 1 teaspoon of whiskey.
Okay, 1 teaspoon of whiskey. Yeah. Put them in the dark?
No,
a jar. Put them in a jar in 3 days, they write me. Thank you. Do you hear that? Okay. A tip on how to get ripe persimmons in less than a month. All right. Back to this. Can we get a photo? Sarah.
Now.
Can you yell?
Yes. I don't have that's easy. You know, I'm into costumes, most of you know that, and there's a couple of people here that would like to accompany me to Trader Joe's, who's invited us to come there in costumes, and we can take our pictures on their really good-looking harvest thing. And big harvest, please. Thank you. I need more people like you. So next weekend, the next Friday, if you are at all interested in doing something little that's fun for the holiday, wear something that's Halloween, anything, a hat, a mask, a full-on costume, and to class. And then right after class, we're going to go to Trader Joe's, get our pictures taken. For me, that's important because there's nothing in the world going on in my family for Halloween. So I just thought, just for me, I heard they don't show up, they just 2 hours away.
You're talking about De La Vina, Trader Joe's?
Oh, yes, yes, De La Vina.
Okay.
So that's all I need.
Thank you. So to reiterate, if you wear a costume next week to class, I'm talking a little about Halloween next week anyway. Wear a costume next week to class and you can go right over to Trader Joe's and get your picture taken in front of the harvest display that they have, which is great. Beautiful display. Great work. Okay, so Carrie.
So which Trader Joe's?
Trader Joe's, De La Vina. It's the one close by here, De La Vina. We used to have in this class a revolving art fair. As people used to bring in their artwork week by week. And we would kind of take a look at it. People could go up at before or after class. We haven't done that this time. But let's, on the last class, if you want to bring in some artwork, let's put it all around the room, and we'll take at least a little time so we can focus on each person's work. So if you would like to bring in a little of your artwork, the last class would be the time to do that. Let's have an art fair. Okay?
Yeah.
Good. All right, now, back to this. Everybody? So back to this. Two things at the same time that you're doing, which seem to be opposite, but actually meld together beautifully. One thing that you're doing is you're letting go of tension on all levels. That is, you're softening and opening your head, the core of your body, your appendages, internal organs, your mind, your emotions. You're just letting everything, all the edges, all the tightness, go like this. So there's a progressive softening and opening, so that you're less and less separate from what's around you, and more a piece with what's around you. So you're kind of expanding your field of being until there's no difference between you and capital B being. You just let, but you don't make that happen, you just release into that opening. That's the first thing. But if you just did that, you go to sleep. So the second thing is, as you let go of tension, you gain attention. That is, your awareness becomes more precise. So you're able to track, and use labeling if you wish, but track every thought, every feeling, every sensation, if you can. So as you're becoming more calm and clear, you're becoming more able to notice every bit of experience. It's like if you have a roiled up surface to a pond, you can't see anything on it. But as your pond becomes clear, then everything can be reflected on it very accurately. So the more peaceful your and unperturbed your consciousness is, the more you can easily note what is occurring within that consciousness. And that's the dual thing that we're doing. It's not really an effort. It's a dual changing of perspective. So that's what you're doing in these 10 minutes. So that's what you're attempting in these 10 minutes if you're doing mindfulness. But there will be no voice to bring you back to your breathing. The bottom line in all this is come back to your breathing, because if you're lost in thought, when you come back to your breathing, you'll come out of being lost in thought. So the bottom line is just find your breathing, relax around it, soften and open around it, and then open your awareness around your breathing so that you become a field of awareness, a breathing in the middle of it, and a noting of everything that occurs as it occurs. I'll ring that bell in 10 minutes. when you do your own sittings, if you're practicing by yourself, there's a rhythm to it. There's a kind of a progress to it. It takes a little while for you to get calm and clear. Some days, very quickly. Other days, if there's a lot of agitation in the system, it takes quite a number of minutes before there's a calmness and a clarity. You can't rush that. You just have to keep coming back to the breathing, softening and opening, until you have that witnessing perspective, until you're calm, until things are quieted down, until you can clearly know what's going on. And then for a while, you can do that. How long you do that, I think you shouldn't force yourself to do that for any particular period of time. I think you should do that for as long as it feels good to do that. But there's a certain point at which that will be enough, and your system will start to get agitated again. And that's when you come back out into the world. So I don't, some people set a timer, but I kind of just sit, and sometimes I don't have time to go through the whole progression because of life, but you know, if I sit, I just kind of let myself calm down. I let myself stay in that witnessing state for as long as feels appropriate. And then when it's time to come out of that, there's a kind of rising of energy again into the system. And that can take anywhere from 10 minutes to much, much longer. But that's what I suggest, is you kind of go, each day is going to have kind of a different trajectory. Each day you'll notice different things, it'll have a different quality to it. And each day there'll be kind of a different time frame that is optimal. That's my, you know, my read on it. Some people like to just know they're going to sit for 15 minutes, you know, and if you're accustomed to that, do it that way, because your system will know to adopt that kind of pacing. I would love to talk about mindfulness further now, but I'm not going to, because in a very few minutes I'm going to talk about a very lot of stuff, because I need to prepare us for the video that we're going to see that is, I think, so important. So, for this week, the two application exercises were savoring and flow. Savoring is pretty straightforward. Some people do this on a regular basis. It was nothing new. For other people, there's never any time to savor, so it becomes the hardest exercise because where you're finding time. I hope that you were able to find at least a few minutes this week to savor something. If not, that exercise is still a challenge for you. It's still there for you. With regard to flow, flow is the extreme of engagement. What we're doing is we're moving in our exploration of what makes people well and happy. We're moving from the life of pleasure, which is what we've been considering up until now, to the life of engagement. And the extreme of engagement is getting lost in what you're doing. But you can be quite engaged and still have self-consciousness, and still realize what you're doing is very wonderful, and still realize what you're doing is very challenging. So flow is the most accentuated or the most defined kind of engagement, or the most kind of pure kind of engagement. But many of us don't get into flow very much, but we do get very engaged with what we're doing. That's okay. You don't have to go into flow to be engaged. That's a confusion that runs through authentic happiness. But I would be curious, how many of you at least once this week went into flow, really the state of getting lost in something wonderful? Raise your hands if you did. So most of us did. Children do this routinely. Children just know how to go into flow. They lose themselves. They lose time. They're always, come on, it's time for dinner. Where the heck are you? You know. So this is something that is natural to human beings, but it gets lost somehow in the process of maturing. So for many of us, we have to rediscover what gives us flow, or we discover, when I do this exercise with people, a lot of people say, I don't know, that doesn't happen to me. That's a great loss, I think. I think engagement is wonderful, but I think flow, the extreme of engagement, is really the most fulfilling. And if there's nothing in your life currently that gives you that level of engagement, then I think you need to look for it. And people at quite advanced ages find that. Oftentimes they find that in creativity, which is one reason why I think the arts and crafts classes are so popular at CLL, because people really get passionate about this stuff. Yeah. By the way, flow and passion, I don't know if they're any different. They're kind of the same thing, you know. So the question is there something that you're passionate about? Now, one distinction I have to make is the distinction between getting lost in mindless stuff and having flow. That's called getting lost in mindless stuff like watching TV. That's not flow, because the components of flow are, it has to be very absorbing, but it also has to challenge you. It has to match your skill, and the challenge have to match, and then you get lost in it because you're using everything that you have to meet that challenge. If you don't invest your energy in it, it doesn't give you the return. It's just wasted time. And actually, it does the opposite frequently. People watch TV for 2 hours and go, where did that time go? Why could I use that time? The problem is, mindlessly getting lost is easy. You don't have to do anything to and it memorizes you. Whereas flow means you really have to give the best of yourself to something, and that people have a hard time mounting that energy. But it always has that return. Mike Csikszentmihalyi, the flow guy, Csikszentmihalyi is how his name is pronounced. Csikszentmihalyi. Okay. So Mike says that flow builds psychological capital. That is, if you get into flow a lot, it strengthens your psyche. You're more apt to deal well with the world for those experiences, because those experiences somehow elevate you. They enlarge you as a human being. So if you flow is something to pay attention to, because it's such a fulfilling thing to know how to do. And again, if you don't have habitual flow in your life, the question is why not, and where could you get it? And one way to look at where to get it is look at the past. Look at where you used to have it when you were a kid. Or look at what you put away because it was impractical when you were a kid. You know, I could never be a dancer, you know, or I could never be a... And maybe you want to dust off some of those dreams, because maybe those dreams are where flow happens for you. Those old dreams. So that's really where the passion was that you buried. And that's where the flow can come. So, Michael.
Can you really have passion for something you have no talent in? And what happens if you...
Absolutely. You can. Absolutely. Because the formula, those of you who remember when I showed you that video of Mike Csikszentmihalyi, if you want to know more about this, go on TED. Mike Csikszentmihalyi gave a beautiful talk about flow, which I'm not going to have time to show you. But what he said is all that's required is a match between challenge and skill. So if you have very little skill, you can still get into flow if you have the appropriate amount of challenge. So if you're a terrible golfer, you know, no, golfing isn't good because it's so good. If you're a terrible tennis player, if you're playing against somebody else equally terrible, you can get into flow, or a little better than you, but still terrible, you can get into flow. Because it takes everything you have to just figure out how to stumble along, you know? And as you get better, then you have to take on a higher challenge to keep that equation between challenge and flow. So even at a very low level, even when you're just starting to paint, you can get into flow because it's so challenging just to kind of figure out how to put the brush to the paper, you know? And then as you get better, then you have to take a greater challenge. But yeah, at any point you can go into flow if the challenge matches the skill. Okay? And so they're going to rise together. Paul.
Can you have flow if you're doing something that you're really not enjoying?
No. That's immersion in something, but it's not flow because it doesn't have the voluntary positive quality. So you can be very immersed in doing your taxes, you know, but you don't get the elevation from that, because it's something that was coerced. It was something that you had to do. It wasn't something that you elected and that called forth the positive part of your personality.
Even if you're very satisfied with the results and feel like you do it well.
Oh, well, if that's true, then it kind of has a more flow quality, because it's something that was difficult. But it was satisfying because you invested your skill in it. So flow doesn't have to be something that is easy or positive on its face. It has to be something that when you have accomplished it, you go, I'm a bigger person for that. That brought out the best in me. Right? So people that, the archetypal example is the mountain climbers. You know, you're freezing your... Often you're in danger of dying, you know, but you get up to the top and you go, I feel better now than I could ever feel anywhere else. But the process of getting there was a hell. So that kind of thing can get is a huge flow bringer. But if it's something that's coerced, when you get done with it, you say, thank God I'm done with it. That's not flow. That's coercion. Okay.
Isn't necessarily black or white. There could be some gray.
What I'm saying is engagement, which is the life we're moving into, flow is the extreme of it, but there are various levels of engagement. Okay, we have to move on. Okay. Not there. Okay, authentic happiness 7. No, we're doing okay. In the chapter that many of you read, I want to point out two things in particular. Again, the frustration is I wish we had time to have a big general discussion about what you read. I think we will have time in subsequent weeks. Some of these chapters need quite a bit of discussion. 8 and 9. Chapter 9 that you're going to read, you're going to read two chapters for next week. Chapter 9 is all about identifying your signature strengths. I'm going to show you how to do that in a little while. Chapter 9 isn't a particularly edifying chapter, and most of it you don't even read, because you're going to take the questionnaire I show you how to take, not the questionnaire that's in the book, which is a lame example. Okay. So chapter 9 is kind of a throwaway. It does have a before and after the questionnaire, there's stuff worth reading. Well, the whole thing is worth reading, but it's not an edifying chapter. Chapter 8, on the other hand, which is short, really is a cool chapter. It's a chapter about recent history and how we look at who we are. It's a profound chapter. There are profound endnotes that go with it. The chapter 8 is a great chapter. We'll probably talk about that in some detail next week. But chapter 7, which we read for this week, the basic argument is there are ways to increase pleasure at the present moment. The last 2 weeks, we looked at ways to increase pleasure about the past and the future. This was how to increase pleasure about the present. And then there was a discontinuity. Then he said, now we're moving from pleasure to gratification. Now we're moving to a different, higher level of understanding, a more authentic kind of happiness. That's when he talked about flow, which is the extreme of engagement. But we're going to be talking about engagement in many forms, not just as the extreme. So the two things I wanted to point out to you in the chapter are, and you don't have to go here, but I'll tell you where this is. This is the top of page 118. I'll tell you what he talked about. All right, if you want to go to the top of page 118. But it's not important, okay? 120 is more important. I'll get you there. But 118, what he's saying is, he's talking about the incidence of depression. You remember? And he's saying, very curious, in all developed countries or developing countries, as the country develops, the rate of depression skyrockets. And in the United States and other developed countries, the rate of depression now versus 1960 is 10 times the rate of depression. And the average age at which depression is first diagnosed has gone from 29.5 to 14.5, so it's half. Okay. So his explanation for that is true. Okay, that's data that's solid. His explanation is shortcuts. which is a good explanation. It's just not a good enough explanation. So shortcuts are, what he's saying is, we have too many easy pleasures. Easy pleasures are like addictions. They leave you wanting more pleasure, but they don't really satisfy you. That's the problem with addictions, is they promise, but they don't deliver. They just get you running after them again. And, you know, addictions are of all kinds. You know, buy something, for a moment you're happy, you look at a great thing, then you're unhappy again, let me get something else, you know, so it's it doesn't satisfy. So he says we have all these shortcuts now. We have all this media, we have chocolate, we have, you know, all these things that we porn, we have all this stuff, you know, it doesn't really do it. So he says that's why people are depressed, is because they're seduced by all these easy pleasures that don't take any of themselves to actualize. And that's, I think, a very profound understanding, that the shortcuts, you don't want to cut them out entirely, but you don't want to build your life around shortcuts. A life of hedonism is going to be a life of getting sour. And you see that in people that have a very easy life. Kids that have a very easy life, frequently they're not very happy. You know, they walk around, they get out of their Ferrari with a scowl on their face. But I think that there are three other really important reasons for the incidence of depression. Let me finish, Fred, and then, okay? The three other important factors that feed into the incidence of depression that is so great, the fact that about a third of the world's population, they estimate at this point, is clinically depressed. That's a lot of folks. Now, I don't know what that translates into in the United States, but probably about a third. But I do know that, I mean, you know this, I told you this before, many of you. How many prescriptions for antidepressants were written in the United States last year? I don't know. The statistics I know are 7 years old. 7 years ago, there were 160 million prescriptions for antidepressants written in the United States. Now, not everybody takes the, you know, fills it. Not everybody keeps taking it. Some need to change antidepressants or combine antidepressants. So let's be conservative. Let's say half of those. So 80 million. That's one out of every four men, women, and children of any age in the United States taking antidepressant medication. I think that's probably too high. I think it's probably one out of five. Something like that. But the point is, a lot of folks. And a lot of the people that are depressed, of course, don't take medication, aren't diagnosed. So the point is, there's a lot of depression. Why is that? The most important reason why the depression has gone 10 times in the last 50 years is because of diagnosis. It's a diagnosis effect. In 1960, if you went to the doctor and you said, I'm feeling kind of down, the doctor says, all right, get over it. Now the doctor says, depression. I got this Paxil here. I just got it. You know, they just said it to me. Try this, you know. For two reasons. First, because doctors want to relieve misery, and that's a good thing. And they recognize depression now, which they didn't used to. Second thing, is because they don't want to get sued in case you do something to yourself. They might as well diagnose you with depression so it's on the books. 70% of the prescriptions for antidepressant medication are written by primary care physicians, often on the first visit. So these are people that are not trained in diagnosing depression, but they diagnose it on the first visit and they give you antidepressant medication. They don't tell you that there are side effects and that there are alternative antidepressant medications like psychotherapy, which really does work and has longer term effects, you know, and it's going to be a lot cheaper in the long run because you don't have to keep going to psychotherapy forever. So in any event, much of this is a diagnosis effect, and the reason we see it in all developing countries is as they develop the infrastructure to diagnose depression better, so you see that incidence rising. Not that depression isn't rising, but it isn't rising 10 times in 50 years. Next thing, two other reasons for the predominance of depression in anxiety, because they're comorbid. More than 50% of people also are clinically anxious, and more than 50% of people who are anxious are clinically depressed. They go together, as many of you know. They don't always go together, but they typically go together. In any event, The other, Carl.
Is this simply the anxiety about the change in society accompanying development?
I'm going to talk about the two reasons now, okay? There are more than two reasons, but I'm going to simplify it. But here are the two reasons why we find much more depression. First reason, disconnection. Human beings, you know this, human beings have evolved to live and work and be in groups of 20 to 30, extended families. Look at primate groups, that's the size they are. That's the size that human beings are comfortable with. But we don't live with our extended families. They're thousands of miles away. They're in homes over here. We have disconnected the structure that makes people feel secure, taken care of, connected. So the disconnection of modern life has led people to anxiety and depression. Anxiety because it's scary without people around you to help you, and because you say the same thing, Julie. You say I don't have friends. If we were living in a tribe, you wouldn't have any choice. Your friends would be all around you,
yeah.
And if you were not, if you were frowning, people would be in your face. What's wrong? What's wrong? The other thing about it is when the people are around, if you fall, you don't fall down. They catch you on the way down. Here you can fall a long way and nobody's going to find out unless you got a life alert, you know. Okay. All right, anyway. So one obvious reason for the incidence of depression in developing and developed societies is because people don't feel connected, and that's deep inside us to need that connection. And it makes us feel secure, it makes us feel loved, it's just something that is deep in us that we're lacking.
Also, isn't there like what I call pseudo connection, like Facebook?
Oh yeah, the whole social media thing is a statement of the fact of how much people need connection. Unfortunately, it's a simulacrum. A sham. It doesn't provide the level of connection that actually satisfies you. You actually need people. It's not just 500 friends that you never met. Okay, it doesn't work. Okay. All right, that's the first thing. I got like five more minutes before we have to shift gears. So next thing. The other aspect of why I think there's so much more depression is inauthenticity. People are not living authentic lives. They're not, because of what they perceive as the social pressures, they're afraid to be who they really are. They're afraid to admit it to themselves. They're afraid to admit it to other people. So they're living inauthentic lives. Now, this is nothing new. Søren Kierkegaard, the Danish philosopher who wrote in the early 1800s, said in one of the greatest statements, by the way, I found this out from Carl Rogers, who harkened back to Søren Kierkegaard. Kierkegaard said, the common despair is to not choose to be who one is. The common despair is to not choose to be who one is. And the deepest despair is to choose to be other than who one is. The deepest despair is to choose to be other than who one is. And he also said, the way out of despair is to will, to choose to be who one truly is. The way out of despair is to choose to be who one truly is. And I think he's talking about depression and the fact that if you're not really living an authentic life, that it's going to make you feel unhappy and like you lost yourself and you lost life. So this is a huge one. It's very hard for people to admit how they actually feel, what they actually want, who they really are. And it's even harder to get them to step into that and live from that understanding. Those of you who remember Michael Geiss, when he came to talk to us about psychotherapy, he came twice. He's the psychiatrist who actually does psychotherapy. What he looks for is he looks for a moment in their conversation when the person comes alive. And that's what he wants to see. That's what he wants to grow. Because that's a moment when the person has come out of their safe show their shell, their persona of who they are, into an actual touching of their deep, vital nature. So, Leah, you're there. Running, okay, so Fred, and then I gotta tell you one more thing, and then we gotta switch gears. I gotta go online.
I couldn't help but think of Alvin Toffler's book in the 70s, Future Shock, wondering if the advancing of the rate of change in society and technology comes to a point where people can no longer just endure it. It starts to show up.
Well, sure. I mean, the insecurity that comes with feeling like what you need to know is advancing faster than you can catch up with it makes people incredibly anxious. It's a race, and you can never win that race, because even if you graduate today with a degree in computer science, tomorrow some 14-year-old is going to know more than you, because it's going to change that quickly, you know? That's what they say in the Life is a Fixed Computers. When you come in with a really arcane question, they look at the youngest kid that's just kind of hanging around the counter and say, yes, that one. All right, next thing. At the bottom of page 120, I'm going to read to you. You don't have to go there. I'm going to read a statement to you. This summarizes where we have been thus far in our understanding. The bottom of page 120. This is Marty speaking. I detailed this. Okay. He's talking about a life built on positive emotion, which is the first part of our understanding. A life built up, the pleasure life, the life built on positive emotion. He says, I detail the strategies under your voluntary control that are likely to move your level of positive emotion into the upper part of your set range of happiness. So remember, you have a set range of happiness. How do you come to the upper part of your set range of happiness for positive emotion? Gratitude, forgiveness, and escaping the tyranny of determinism to increase positive emotion about the past. So as you become more grateful, more forgiving, and you realize that the past does not determine your future, it just influences it, then you have better emotion about the past. Learning hope and optimism through disputation to increase positive emotion about the future, that is thinking differently, as we've explored, to change your view of the future, and breaking habituation, savoring, and mindfulness to increase the pleasures of the present. And that was what the chapter was about, is not habituating, that is spacing out one's pleasure, varying one's pleasure, so that you don't become inured to pleasure. Savoring and mindfulness, in the most trivial sense of mindfulness, which is paying attention to the present rather than the past and the future. But anyway, that's where we've been so far. Okay, now where we're going is the life of engagement, and your assignment for next week is identify your signature strengths. I'm going to show you how to do that right now. Each day, note which ones you use and how you did so. Try to use them as often as possible and to find new ways to use them. I'm going to email you this afternoon or this evening the instructions which I'm going to give you now. Okay? But I'm going to show you how to do this now and then email you a set of instructions.
I don't have email.
So you can find, well, then pay attention now. Okay. So, what we need is, we need to have the auditorium dark. So we can do this. Yeah.
Could we get the name of this so we can write it down while there's light?
Name of what?
Are you going to do a video?
Oh, we're going to have light again in a minute. I'm going to throw the lights on, so don't worry about it. We're not going to a video yet.
Okay.
This is a website. I'll tell you the video in a minute. So, watch that. Good? It rings. A little light right now. First thing you do is, and again, I'm going to send this to you. You go, but I wanted you to see it. You go to, forget all the rest of that stuff on the address. You go to authentichappiness.org. Again, I'm going to email it to you, but you go to authentichappiness.org, and that brings this screen up, which is the website of the Positive Psychology Center at the University of Pennsylvania, where Marty works. There's a bunch of cool stuff on there that you can play with, but here's what I want you to do. Turn it off again for a minute. You go in the middle where it says questionnaires. Got that so far? You hear authentichappiness.org, you go to questionnaires. There's going to be a subtlety here. Click get started. Questionnaires, get started. Maybe. You go like that. Click get started. Okay? And unfortunately, if you don't look closely, you're going to not see what we need. Because there seem to be like 4-8 questionnaires there. But that's not what we need. What we need to do is we need to scroll down to another set of questionnaires here. You're going to see the VIA Survey of Strengths for Children. Don't take that unless you're under 12 or 14 or something. Go down here. There is one for children. It's actually about 10 to 17. Children take that. You go to this one, the VIA Survey of Character Strengths.
All right.
Again, I'm going to email this to you, but the VIA Survey of Character Strengths.
What does VIA mean?
Values in Action.
What does that mean?
So you go to the, okay, so you've gone questionnaires, get started, VIA Survey of Character Strengths, you click on that. And you have to log in. Do this, okay? They will not bot, they will not spam you, they will not solicit from you. They just want, they want your data, is what they want. They're gleaning your data, okay? But they're not going to individualize you in any way. Give them your email address. Give them your email address is the best, okay? And then make a password. Oh, I'm sorry. You're not going to have done this, so you can't do this. The next time you come back, you'll do this. You have to go down here to register. You have to go to register, see? Click on register, and up will come a bunch of stuff. Do that, then it will take you automatically to the VIA Survey of Character Strengths. So, you can just go back. So, what you're doing, go back again. What you're doing is you're going questionnaires, get started. Go down to the VIA Survey of Character Strengths. Click on that. Click on register, and then you register, and then it takes you to the survey. Now, the survey. It's 240 questions, but it goes very quickly, take you half an hour. Don't agonize about the questions. Even if it seems stupid, I hate these surveys. You do too, they try to put you in a box. You're not going to know how to answer some of the questions. Don't agonize. Just put the answer that immediately occurs to you. Just go through it quickly, okay? It turns out that they're not so dumb. That even if the questions seem dumb, what you're going to get out of this is not dumb. What you're going to get is a listing of the 24 possible strengths of character listed from the ones that are highest in you to the ones that are least high in you. These are all strengths, they're not weaknesses, but there's an ordering. The ones that are highest are the ones that you are the most developed in at this point. Okay? So from this listing, you're going to choose from the top 7 or 8, you're going to choose 2 to 5 as your signature strengths. What are signature strengths? These are strengths that you're already very good in, that you identify with, that you really love, that you want to use more. So let's say I have 5, I'm looking at my top 7 strengths, and one of them is leadership. Is that my signature strength? I mean, I'm very good at that, according to this survey. Is that one of my signature strengths? No. I do not like to do that. It's just something that I do well, and so I get to, I'm pushed into those positions. So what you're doing is from the top 7 or 8 strengths, you're choosing 2 to 5 that are the strengths that you love. Now, if there's a strength that's number 17 that you love, you don't get to say that's one of my signature strengths, because it's not one of the strengths that's highly developed. So you choose 2 to 5 of the top ones to be your signature strengths. If you want to take one from lower that you really wish were one of your signature strengths, you can take one from lower and you can put it in your list, because you can train it up. But if you pay, the problem is we focus on our weaknesses. They always told us you got to pay attention to your weaknesses. If you do that, if you focus on your weaknesses, you're going to spend a lot of energy and get nowhere, and you're going to get very upset. If you focus on the things that you're already good at and you deploy them in your life as much as possible, it will bring the whole thing up. The weaknesses will have a tendency to self-correct. So choose 2 to 5 signature strengths from the top of your list. Maybe take one from lower that you want to train up, and do the following. And again, this is all on the instructions. Write them down on the left-hand side of a piece of paper. Got 3 signature strengths, this, this, and this. Along the top, I put the days of the week. And then what I'm doing is, each evening, I'm tracking which of the 3 strengths I use that day. I'm making a matrix. If I use zest, I put ran. I put a little two-word, a little tiny description of what I did. If I didn't use humor that day, I leave it blank. If I used gratitude that day, I said, donated to this organization. No. So what you do is you're tracking the usage of your signature strengths over a 2-week period. Next week and the week after. Do it for 2 weeks. What you'll see is some interesting things. You'll see which ones you use. You'll see which ones you don't use as much. The ideal would be to use your strengths every day in new ways. To use them as much as possible in your life, in all the areas of your life. To use them frequently. To use them all. And to use them in increasingly various ways. So, making this matrix shows you what you're using and not using from your signature strengths and encourages you to use your strengths more often. So if creativity is one of my signature strengths and I'm not using it, the question is, why not? If you identify your signature strengths and you rarely use them, there's a lot of air in your matrix, the question is, what kind of life are you living? The best of you is not getting into your life? What's wrong with this picture? Right. So that's the assignment for next week. This is really powerful. So that's why I've talked to many of you about this, or some of you about this before in class, but this makes you do it in a kind of more disciplined way. We have to change gears. Again, I will email this to you.
I don't like it. I need it.
Say it again?
I don't like the instruction.
Okay. Julie, I'll give you the instructions after.
Okay.
Okay, so... Now what I have to do...
Book.
What?
You can do it in the book.
Oh, you can also... Yeah, right. You can do it right in the book. You don't have to do this at all. You can do it in the book. You'll see. It's in chapter 9. You'll see. Okay. All right.
I did it out of the book, and then I went online, and the results were fairly significantly.
Yeah. It's,
so there are many more items online, many more questions.
Yeah, it's true that, Chris is right, it's true that, you'll get a pretty good read from doing it in the book, but you just get a better read from doing it online. So do it online if you can. Okay, now I've got to tell you what we're about to see. This is a really profound talk, so I have to set it up for you just the tiniest bit so I don't interrupt it. By the way, this is John Haidt, H-A-I-D-T, who is a remarkable guy. He's probably the world expert on moral psychology at this point. He's certainly one of the world experts on why we consider certain things to be moral, that is good. Why do we consider this to be good and this to be bad? Where does this come from? Okay. So, I got to explain four things and you're going to listen to him talk about this. By the way, he talks real fast. First, the mate.
How you spell his name?
H-A-I-D-T. H-A-I-D-T. It's pronounced Haidt. And this is a TED talk. You probably want to see it again. So, first, the Matrix. He's going to talk about the Matrix. Those of you who've seen the movie The Matrix, The Matrix is a virtual reality in which we are stuck thinking that this is reality. So if you're in The Matrix, according to him, you're stuck in a set of ideas which blind you to the actual truth. Okay? That is, The Matrix is in your mind. It blinds you to the actual facts of life. So he's saying we're stuck in a moral matrix. We've learned, we've heard a bunch of stuff, and now we believe this is true, and it may not be serving us. Okay. Second thing, talks about a tabula rasa. Most of the 20th century in psychology, it was believed that kids came into the world a blank slate, a tabula rasa, and experience wrote personality on that blank slate. How you were raised formed your personality. Now we know that's one of the stupidest ideas that we ever had. Genetics has a huge amount to do with personality. You come into the world prepared to be certain ways, learn certain things. So tabula rasa is not true. Five factors. He's going to talk about five factors that we come into the world predisposed to look at the world in terms of. That is, evolutionarily, these factors have persisted because they have helped the species survive and thrive. So we come into the world prepared to learn that these things are good and the opposites are bad. We come in with a moral structure already in place. And that if you, these are powerful, deep, deep, deep things in us that we can't ignore except at our peril. Finally, he talks about Seng San, the Zen master, who talks about not... I'm going to have a whole class for you. I have a whole long poem of Seng San. I'm going to go over that again because it's so profound. What Seng San says is, the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. Let me quote slightly, slightly bit more. Okay. When love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. Make the slightest distinction, however, and heaven and earth are set infinitely far apart. What Seng San says is, your opinion about what you like and what you don't like blinds you to what is. All right, so having said that, listen closely, you're going for a ride. This is John Haidt. By the way, I apologize he's going to divide the United States into two categories. He's going to use an objectionable term for one of those areas. Please kind of overlook that.
So let's go to
I'm sure there'll be some commentary about this. Probably have about 5 minutes to talk.
So here goes.
Get out of the way.
and friends are traveling together in Italy. They go to see Michelangelo's David. When they finally come face to face with the statue, they both freeze dead in their tracks. The first guy, we'll call him Adam, is transfixed by the beauty of the perfect human form. The second guy, we'll call him Bill, is transfixed by embarrassment at staring at the thing there in the center. So here's my question for you. Which one of these two guys is more likely to vote for George Bush? I have to show hands because we all have the same political stereotypes. We all know that is Bill. And in this case, the stereotype corresponds to reality. It really is a fact that liberals are much higher than conservatives on a major personality trait called openness to experience. People who are high in openness to experience just crave novelty, variety, diversity, new ideas, travel. People low on it like things that are familiar, that are safe and dependable. If you know about this trait, you can understand a lot of puzzles about human behavior. You can understand why artists are so different from accountants. You can actually predict what kinds of books they like to read, what kinds of places they like to travel to, and what kinds of food they like to eat. Once you understand this trait, you can understand why anybody would leave Applebee's, not anybody that you know. This trait also tells us a lot about politics. The main researcher of this trait, Robert McCrae, says that open individuals have an affinity for liberal, progressive, left-wing political views. They like a society which is open and changing. Whereas closed individuals prefer conservative, traditional, right-wing views. This trait also tells us a lot about the kinds of groups people join. So here's a description of a group I found on the web. What kinds of people would join a global community welcoming people from every discipline and culture who seek a deeper understanding of the world and who hope to turn that understanding into a better future for us all? It's just some guy named Ted. Well, let's see now. If openness predicts who becomes liberal and openness predicts who becomes a Tedster, then might we predict that most Tedsters are liberal? Let's find out. I'm going to ask you to raise your hand whether you are liberal, left of center on social issues we're talking about primarily, or conservative. And I'll give a third option because I know there are a number of libertarians in the audience. So right now, please raise your hand down in the simulcast rooms too. Let's let everybody see who's here. Please raise your hand if you would say that you are liberal or left of center. Please raise your hand high right now. Okay. Please raise your hand if you say you're libertarian. Okay, about two dozen. And please raise your hand if you say you're right of center or conservative. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, about 8 or 10. Okay. This is a bit of a problem. Because if our goal is to understand the world, to seek a deeper understanding of the world, our general lack of moral diversity here is going to make it harder. Because when people all share values, when people all share morals, they become a team. And once you engage the psychology of teams, it shuts down open-minded thinking. when the liberal team loses, as it did in 2004, as it did in, we comfort ourselves. We try to explain why half of America voted for the other team. We think they must be blinded by religion, or by simple stupidity. So if you think that half of America votes Republican because they are blinded in this way, then my message to you is that you're trapped in a moral matrix, in a particular moral matrix. And by the matrix, I mean literally the matrix, like the movie The Matrix. But I'm here today to give you a choice. You can either take the blue pill and stick to your comforting delusions, or you can take the red pill, learn some moral psychology, and step outside the moral matrix. Now, because I know... Okay, I assume that answers my question. I was going to ask you which one you take, but no need. You're all high openness to experience, and besides, it looks like it might even taste good, and you're all epicures. So anyway, let's go with the red pill. Let's study some moral psychology and see where it takes us. Let's start at the beginning. What is morality, and where does it come from? The worst idea in all of psychology is the idea that the mind is a blank slate at birth. Developmental psychology has shown that kids come into the world already knowing so much about the physical and social worlds, and programmed to make it really easy for them to learn certain things and hard to learn others. The best definition of innateness I've ever seen, this just clarifies so many things for me, is from the brain scientist Gary Marcus. He says, the initial organization of the brain does not depend that much on experience. Nature provides the first draft, which experience then revises. Built in doesn't mean unmalleable, it means organized in advance of experience. Okay, so what's on the first draft of Moral Mind? To find out, my colleague Craig Joseph and I read through the literature on anthropology, on cultural variation and morality, and also on evolutionary psychology, looking for matches. What are the sorts of things that people talk about across disciplines, that you find across cultures, and even across species? We found five best matches, which we call the five foundations of morality. The first one is harm care. We're all mammals here. We all have a lot of neural and hormonal programming that makes us really bond with others, care for others, feel compassion for others, especially when weak and vulnerable. It gives us very strong feelings about those who cause harm. This moral foundation underlies about 70% of the moral statements I've heard here at TED. The second foundation is fairness, reciprocity. There's actually ambiguous evidence as to whether you find reciprocity in other animals, but the evidence for people could not be clearer. This Norman Rockwell painting is called The Golden Rule, and we heard about this from Karen Armstrong, of course, as the foundation of so many religions. That second foundation underlies the other 30% of the moral statements I heard here at TED. Third foundation is in-group loyalty. You do find groups in the animal kingdom, you do find cooperative groups, but these groups are always either very small or they're all siblings. It's only among humans that you find very large groups of people who are able to cooperate, join together into groups, but in this case, groups that are united to fight other groups. This probably comes from our long history of tribal living, of tribal psychology, and this tribal psychology is so deeply pleasurable that even when we don't have tribes, we can go ahead and make them because it's fun. Sports is to war as pornography is to sex. We get to exercise some ancient tribes. The fourth foundation is authority and respect. Here you see submissive gestures from two members of very closely related species. But authority in humans is not so closely based on power and brutality as it is in other primates. It's based on more voluntary deference and even elements of love at times. The fifth foundation is purity and sanctity. This painting is called The Allegory of Chastity. But purity is not just about suppressing female sexuality. It's about any kind of ideology, any kind of idea that tells you that you can attain virtue by controlling what you do with your body, by controlling what you put into your body. And while the political right may moralize sex much more, the political left is really doing a lot of it with food. Food is becoming extremely moralized nowadays. And a lot of those ideas are purity, about what you're willing to touch or put into your body. I believe these are the five best candidates for what's written on the first draft of The Moral Mind. I think this is what we come with, at least preparedness, to learn all of these things. But as my son Max grows up in a liberal college town, how is this first draft going to get revised? And how will it end up being different from a kid born 60 miles south of us in Lynchburg, Virginia? To think about cultural variation, let's try a different metaphor. If there really are five systems at work in the mind, five sources of intuitions and emotions, then we can think of the moral mind as being like one of those audio equalizers which has five channels, so we can set it to a different setting on every channel. And my colleagues Brian Nozick and Jesse Graham and I made a questionnaire, which we put up on the web at www.yourmorals.org. And so far, 30,000 people have taken this questionnaire, and you can too. Here are the results. Here are the results from about 23,000 American citizens. On the left, I plotted the scores for liberals. On the right, those for conservatives, and in the middle, the moderates. The blue line shows you people's responses on the average of all harm questions. So as you see, people care about harm and care issues. They get high endorsement of these sorts of statements all across the board, but as you also see, liberals care about it a little more than conservatives. The line slows down. Same story for fairness. But look at the other three lines. For liberals, the scores are very low. Liberals are basically saying, no, this is not morality. In-group authority, this stuff has nothing to do with morality, I reject it. But as people get more conservative, the values rise. We could say that liberals have a kind of a two-channel or two-foundation morality. Conservatives have more of a five-foundation, a five-channel morality. We find this in every country we look at. Here's the data for 1,100 Canadians. I'll just look through a few other slides. The UK, Australia, New Zealand, Western Europe, Eastern Europe, Latin America, the Middle East, the East Asia, and South Asia. Notice also that on all these graphs, the slope is steeper on in-group authority purity, which shows that within any country, the disagreement isn't over harm and fairness. Everybody, I mean, we debate over what's fair, but everybody agrees that harm and fairness matter. Moral arguments within cultures are especially about issues of in-group authority, purity. This effect is so robust that we find it no matter how we ask the question. In one recent study, we ask people to suppose you're about to get a dog, you pick a particular breed, you learn some new information about the breed. Suppose you learn that this particular breed is independent-minded, relates to its owner, a friend and equal. Well, if you're a liberal, you say, hey, that's great, because liberals like to say fetch, please. But if you're conservative, that's not so attractive. If you're conservative and you learn that a dog is extremely loyal to its home and family and doesn't warm up quickly to strangers, for conservative, well, loyalty is good. Dogs ought to be loyal. But to a liberal, it sounds like this dog is running for the Republican nomination. So you might say, okay, there are these differences between liberals and conservatives, but what makes those three other foundations moral? Aren't those just the foundations of xenophobia, authoritarianism, and puritanism? What makes them moral? The answer, I think, is contained in this incredible triptych from Hieronymus Bosch, The Garden of Earthly Delights. In the first panel, we see the moment of creation, all is ordered, all is beautiful, all the people and animals are doing what they're supposed to be doing, where they're supposed to be, but then, given the weight of the world, things change. We get every person doing whatever he wants with every aperture of every other person, every other animal. Some of you might recognize this as the 60s. The 60s inevitably gives way to the 70s, where the cuttings of the apertures hurt a little bit more. Of course, Bosch called this hell. So this triptych, these three panels, portray the timeless truth that order tends to decay. The truth of social entropy. But lest you think this is just some part of the Christian imagination where Christians have this weird problem with pleasure, here's the same story, the same progression, told in a paper that was published in Nature a few years ago, in which Ernst Fehr and Simon Gachter had people play a commons dilemma, a game in which you give people money, and then on each round of the game, they can put money into a common pot, and then the experimenter doubles what's in there, and then it's all divided among the players. So it's a really nice analog for all sorts of environmental issues, where we're asking people to make a sacrifice, and they themselves don't really benefit from their own sacrifice, but you really want everybody else to sacrifice, but everybody has a temptation to free ride. And what happens is that at first people start off reasonably cooperative, result played anonymously. On the first round, people give about half of the money that they can, but they quickly see, you know what, other people aren't doing so much, so I don't want to be a sucker, I'm not going to cooperate, and so cooperation quickly decays from reasonably good down to close to zero. But then, and here's the trick, Fehr and Gachter said on the seventh round, they told people, you know what, new rule, if you want to give some of your own money to punish people who aren't contributing, you can do that. And as soon as people heard about the punishment issue going on, cooperation shoots up. It shoots up and it keeps going up. There's a lot of research showing that to solve cooperative problems, it really helps. It's not enough to just appeal to people's good motives. It really helps to have some sort of punishment, even if it's just shame or embarrassment or gossip. You need some sort of punishment to bring people in their large groups to cooperate. There's even some recent research suggesting that religion, priming God, making people think about God, often in some situations leads to more cooperative, more pro-social behavior. Some people think that religion is an adaptation evolved both by cultural and biological evolution to make groups cohere, in part for the purpose of trusting each other and then being more effective to compete with other groups. I think that's probably right, although this is a controversial issue. But I'm particularly interested in religion, in the origin of religion, and what it does to us and for us, because I think that the greatest wonder in the world is not the Grand Canyon. The Grand Canyon is really simple. It's just a lot of rock and then a lot of water and wind and a lot of time, and you get the Grand Canyon. It's not that complicated. This is what's really complicated, that there were people living in places like the Grand Canyon, cooperating with each other, or on the savannas of Africa, or on the frozen shores of Alaska. And then some of these villages grew into the mighty cities of Babylon and Rome and Tenochtitlan. How did this happen? This is an absolute miracle, much harder to explain than the Grand Canyon. The answer, I think, is that they used every tool in the toolbox. It took all of our moral psychology to create these cooperative groups. Yes, you do need to be concerned about harm, you do need the psychology of justice, but it really helps organize a group if you can have subgroups, and if those subgroups have some internal structure, and if you have some ideology that tells people to suppress their carnality, to pursue higher, nobler ends. And now we get to the crux of the disagreement between liberals and conservatives. Because liberals reject three of these foundations. They say, no, let's celebrate diversity, not common group membership. They say, let's question authority, and they say, keep the laws off my body. Liberals have very noble motives for doing this. Traditional authority, traditional morality, can be quite repressive and restrictive to those at the bottom, to women, to people who don't fit in. So liberals speak for the weak and oppressed. They want change and justice, even at the risk of chaos. This guy's shirt says, stop bitching, start a revolution. If you're high on this to experience, revolution is good, it's change, it's fun. Conservatives, on the other hand, speak for institutions and traditions. They want order, even at some cost, to those at the bottom. The great conservative insight is that order is really hard to achieve, it's really precious, and it's really easy to lose. So as Edmund Burke said, the restraints on men, as well as their liberties, are erected among their rights, which is after the chaos of the French Revolution. So once you see this, once you see that liberals and conservatives both have something to contribute, that they form a balance on change versus stability, Then I think the way is open to step outside the moral matrix. This is the great insight that all the Asian religions have attained. Think about yin and yang. Yin and yang aren't enemies. Yin and yang don't hate each other. Yin and yang are both necessary, like night and day, for the functioning of the world. You find the same thing in Hinduism. There are many high gods in Hinduism. Two of them are Vishnu, the preserver, Shiva, the destroyer. This image actually is both of those gods sharing the same body. You have the markings of Vishnu on the left. So we could think of Vishnu as a conservative god. You have the markings of Shiva on the right. Shiva is the liberal god. And they work together. You find the same thing in Buddhism. These two stances contain, I think, the deepest insights that have ever been attained into moral psychology from the Zen master Sen Tsang. If you want the truth to stand clear before you, never be for or against. The struggle between for and against is the mind's worst disease. Now, unfortunately, it's a disease that has been caught by many of the world's leaders. But before you feel superior to George Bush, before you throw a stone, ask yourself, do you accept this? Do you accept stepping out of the battle of good and evil? Can you be not for or against anything? So what's the point? What should you do? Well, if you take the greatest insights from ancient Asian philosophies and religions, and you combine them with the latest research on moral psychology, I think you come to these conclusions, that our righteous minds were designed by evolution to unite us into teams, to divide us against other teams, and then to blind us to the truth. So what should you do? Am I telling you to not strive? Am I telling you to embrace Sen Tsang and stop? Stop with this struggle for and against? No, absolutely not. I'm not saying that. This is an amazing group of people who are doing so much, using so much of their talent, their brilliance, their energy, their money to make the world a better place, to fight wrongs, to solve problems. But as we learned from Samantha Power in her story about Sergio Vieira de Mello, you can't just go charging in saying you're wrong and I'm right. Because as we just heard, everybody thinks they are right. A lot of the problems we have to solve are problems that require us to change other people. And if you want to change other people, a much better way to do it is to first understand who we are, understand our moral psychology, understand that we all think we're right, and then step out, even if it's just for a moment, step out, check in with Sen Tsang. Step out of the moral matrix, just try to see it as a struggle playing out in which everybody does think they're right. Everybody at least has some reasons, even if you disagree with it, everybody has some reasons for what they're doing. Step out, if you do that, that's the essential move to cultivate moral humility, to get yourself out of this self-righteousness, which is a normal human condition. Think about the Dalai Lama. Think about the enormous moral authority of the Dalai Lama, and it comes from his moral humility. So I think the point of my talk, and I think the point of TED, is that this is a group that's passionately engaged in the pursuit of changing the world for the better. People here are passionately engaged in trying to make the world a better place. But there's also a passionate commitment to the truth. And so I think that the answer is to use that passionate commitment to the truth to try to turn it into a better future for us all. Thank you.
So, let me say a couple words and then we'll take a couple comments. So what he's arguing here is that people are, when they are arguing about these social problems and how we proceed, they're coming from one or another or a group of these basic patterns in the human being. And all these patterns are necessary. They all sum together to make a successful species. So what he's talking about with moral humility is realizing that what you hold fervently as important is important, but what the other person holds fervently as important is also important because they're also coming from a different set of these patterns, and it takes all those five factors to create a stable, viable, fair, growing society. So what's happening in our country right now is increasing polarization. People saying, I'm right and you're wrong, which is being partial about their understanding of what is necessary for a viable society. What he's saying is if we all paid closer attention to not seeing ourselves as right and the other side as wrong, but seeing everybody as having a point of view that is valid, then we would talk, we would discourse with one another and try to come up with the best solutions for the particular issues based on all the needs expressed. This is called postmodernism. Not that there's a one right or wrong answer, but that the best answer is the sum of all well-held answers. Okay, so let's hear what you have to say. But this is profound understanding. I wish that people who are running our country would just listen to this and understand it, if they could. Robert.
Yeah, I sat through 8 weeks of Jonathan Haidt speaking at UCSB, and it was at the time of Proposition 8, you know, the anti-gay initiative?
Yeah.
And I said to him, you know, it's very good that we can understand how conservatives see the world. It doesn't mean that they should have any political authority to take rights away from other people because of their biases. And the thing is, it's not equal. I think there's a lot of false equivalency in this postmodernist view. And there isn't equivalency all the time. Sometimes if you come into an alley and see two guys fighting, it's not because they're both wanting to fight. It's because one of the guys is mugging the other guy.
There are two issues that you brought. The second issue is a more profound one. The first issue, though, about people different than you opposing things that you passionately believe are right, is you can be passionate about what's right, but you have to understand where they're coming from in their opposition, what they're afraid of, what they feel it would be deleterious.
Well, maybe they should see a psychotherapist.
Well, what you suggest, you talk to the other person, you say, I see where you're coming from, I see why you're arguing that way. Here's my rebuttal to that. What's your rebuttal to my rebuttal? You talk about it. You say, you know, there's something you're not realizing. If I can convince you of that, would it change your position?
Look, the Klan had reason to fear black people becoming free. But that doesn't mean that they should have political power.
Well, what it means is we have to listen to all the points of view and address all those points of view if you don't want those people to keep doing what they're doing. If people were committed to the truth as opposed to their opinion, then discussions could come to consensus rather than making more polarization. So you might be right about an issue, but you have to listen to why somebody else is debating with you. Robert.
You know, a different way to say the same thing very simply is, why isn't truth another dimension in his moral matrix? He brings in truth at the end, just like you have. Why isn't truth in there with the other five?
Because truth is... I don't think it belongs on the same level. I think more about this, but that's not the model that I would make. I think that those five things sum at a different level to truth. Okay, they're not. It's not. Truth is not at the same level as these imperatives for flourishing.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean that you just leave truth out of the discussion altogether.
No, he didn't. He said he built. He built the discussion to point toward that that superordinate thing called truth. But he said truth is not on one or the other of these platforms. Truth is on some sort of optimal combination of these basic needs. Okay, anyway, let's see. Last hand, Caroline. Matt, last. Loud, yes.
Do you have everyone's email?
No, I have everyone's email that gave an email. I don't individually email everybody. I email the class. And so if you gave an email in your profile, then I can email it to you. If you didn't give an email in your profile, talk to your neighbor to get the information, because I won't know how to email you. Okay? I just push a button that says email class. But I just showed you how to do it also. Okay, so you should be able to identify your signature strengths. These are huge questions. I mean, I know I didn't fully answer what Robert said or what Robert said.
we can talk about it further, but you know, the point is this is a talk that goes deeply into who we are in the society that we create. It's a talk worth contemplating. All right, have a good week. Identify your signature strengths and start using. See you next week.